who have all the rights to exist, particularly in the land of the ancestors. We therefore call on all of the world to isolate Israel through boycotts, disinvestment, sanctions, until they end their military occupation and allow Palestinian refugees in surrounding countries like Lebanon, Syria, the right of return.
For more on the Israeli regime's evil transactions in Africa, we have contacted Matthew Parks. He's the national spokesperson and parliamentary coordinator of this Congress of South African Trade Unions. Thank you for your time, sir, today.
Thank you.
We also have David Hundane, the founder of the West African Weekly. He's a journalist and an author in London. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, let's start off with Mr. Matthew Parks there in South Africa. The Israeli apartheid regime is currently moving thousands of Africans from countries such as Kenya and Malawi to labor camps inside occupied territories amid its genocidal war in Gaza. So what's your view on this unfortunate move?
Look, we think it's unfortunate. We think that Israel right now is engaged in a brutal war against the Palestinian people, and we should be minimizing contact and trade with Israel. And that would include people from African countries like Malawi and Kenya going to work on their farms. Israel needs to resolve its problems with the Palestinian people because, in effect, that many of these jobs would normally have been occupied by Palestinian people. And because of the war against the Palestinians, they're no longer doing it. So, and hence, in other words, where the Israelis are employing African laborers to try to displace the Palestinian people. So we think it's not helpful. It's making matters worse. And really, the ultimate issue is that Israel has to resolve its relationship with the Palestinian people. We should not be looking for ways to simply subsidize Israeli government's behavior or to give alternatives. And right now, it has to address its issues.
Now, let's bring in Mr. David Hundane. I'm putting the same question to you. The Israeli regime facing an exodus of Zionists and workers from Asia is now moving to Africa for cheap labor. What do you make of this desperate move?
So the unfortunate reality of running the sort of apartheid state that the current Israeli regime runs is that when it so happens that the true face, the true ugliness of what it actually means to run an apartheid state becomes apparent to the world, it causes a lot of embarrassment, and people who previously were happy to be associated with it want to dissociate themselves. So as you rightly said, there's an exodus of people who do not want to be associated with the current actions of the Israeli regime in Gaza and the occupied West Bank. And unfortunately, it seems as if the alternative that has been adopted by the Israeli government is not to re-examine its existing policies and perhaps look for a better way of engaging with the world, but it's rather to sort of entrench itself even deeper further into its historical way of viewing things. And it's now sort of looking toward Africa as the place that will plug the shortfall. And even in the process of doing that, it is not engaging with Africa with any kind of respect. I think it's very opportune to point out and for everyone to remember that during the dark days of apartheid in South Africa, one of the very few countries on this planet that was happy to associate and do business and be affiliated with the South African apartheid regime, had very cordial diplomatic relations with the South African apartheid regime, was the Israeli government. I don't think that's a coincidence.
Konwani Nankumwa, Malawi's opposition leader, spoke in parliament questioning the secrecy of the deal of sending Malawians to work in Israel. He described the deal as an evil transaction. He said the Malawian government has gone into such an agreement with Israeli companies when it is fully aware that there is war.
Israel should really consider how does it build a healthy relationship with the Palestinian people. And they said what they're doing is to seeking basically to expel, to cleanse Palestinian people away from the territories that it's controlling. And in this case, they're seeking then to bring African laborers to Israel in their place. So when African laborers go there, in effect, they're basically supporting the Israeli government. We think this is a problem. Yes, we have seen there are some questions often not just in Israel, but other countries too across the Middle East, who go and recruit African workers to come and work in their countries. And often the conditions are very secret, and often you see that there are real abuses of those workers' rights.
Israel has a very dirty record in Africa. The former head of Israel's Mossad spy agency, Yossi Cohen, was deported from the Democratic Republic of Congo in 2019 after he was suspected of planning a coup against the country's president. Additionally, a company controlled by Israeli billionaire Dan Gertler is involved in massive corruption in the Democratic Republic of Congo, where it illegally gained control of valuable mining and oil assets. Now, the poverty-stricken Democratic Republic of Congo is facing losses of a whopping $3.71 billion. This is for Mr. Hondain. Now, what exactly is the Israeli regime doing in this conflict-ridden country?
The sheer mineral wealth of the DRC, unfortunately, makes it a target and makes it an important country for anyone who has an interest in manufacturing or in geopolitics. And as you rightly said, the Israeli government has a very patchy record in Africa. So it doesn't take much to put two and two together and suggest that based on historical precedents, based on Israeli government's relationship, for example, with the South African apartheid regime, and Israeli government's role in supporting and even training the military of the apartheid regime, even in its operations beyond South Africa, as far afield as Angola, Namibia, Mozambique, I don't think it's too much of a stretch to suggest that something similar is afoot. So it could be an operation to take control of conflict minerals.
Well, thanks for that, Mr. Hondain. Let's now take a short break before we continue with our discussion on some of the evil transactions of the Israeli apartheid regime in Africa. So stay with us.
Israel's evil transactions in Africa.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back, and this week's topic is on some of the evil transactions of the Israeli apartheid regime in Africa. Now, the Israeli regime is also selling weapons that escalate civil wars in Africa. A UN Security Council report revealed that Israeli regime weapons have been used widely in the South Sudan civil war. And by the way, Israel's devastating weapons are tested on Palestinian women and children before being sold to other conflict regions. Now, this is enough reason to boycott these weapons. This question is for Mr. Matthew Parks. Now, it's quite clear that the Israeli regime's military industries put profits ahead of human lives in Africa. What's your view on this aspect of the evil nature of the Israeli regime?
Yes, the Israeli arms industry does fuel these conflicts for profit at the expense of African lives, just like other countries' arms industries who also export to Africa, whether it's the US or the UK or France or Germany, whether it's Russia or China. You'll find almost all of these arms industry across the world end up getting involved in it. South Africa also has an arms industry. We've tried to avoid that going down that route. It's not easy because ultimately these arms companies want to make money like any other company. Countries which are involved in internal civil wars and wars which are not acceptable, not for self-defense and so forth, countries which are driven by ethnic conflict, etc., then nobody should be selling their weapons. And that would, for example, would include in this instance South Sudan, which has really been driven by ethnic conflict, sadly, since it became independent, you know, about two decades ago.
The Israeli apartheid regime recognized Morocco's sovereignty over the disputed territory of Western Sahara. This was part of the evil deal after the Morocco monarchy normalized ties with Tel Aviv in a move that was rejected by the masses. The Western Sahara is a full member of the African Union. Clearly, the Israeli regime has shown total contempt to the African Union. This says a lot about the regime's attitude towards African countries.
What it shows is that the government of Israel, as it has showed multiple times, has very little regard, not just for individual AU member states, but for the AU itself. Because bear in mind that Israel has observer status at the AU, which means it requested for observer status and received observer status. So it recognizes that this is a supranational organization whose decisions ought to be respected. Now, given that the AU has offered full recognition of the Sahrawi Arab Republic, or Western Sahara, as it's otherwise known, this would imply that as an entity with observer status at the AU, you are supposed to go with what the AU says. The AU has recognized this as a country. Yes, Morocco claims to have some sort of ownership claim over Western Sahara, but the AU has recognized, has offered full recognition to Western Sahara, full political recognition, and it's an AU member, right? The Western Sahara is an AU member state.
In yet another evil deal in Africa, the Angolan government plowed $70 million into the 9,000-hectare project and then contracted its implementation to an Israeli agribusiness corporation called LR Group. The project linked to the notorious Israeli military collapsed, and locals say they were used as slave labor by the Israelis. The Israeli regime is using slave labor in Africa to benefit its companies under the guise of transferring agricultural technology. This says a lot about the racist nature of the Israeli regime.
It says what the rest of the regime's history says about it, which is that historically, Israel has adopted an even more conservative line toward African freedom and African anti-colonial activities, and even some of the traditional Western powers. I mentioned earlier that Israel was one of the very few countries that was happy to work with the South African government, even militarily, during the apartheid era.
The racist Israeli regime even commits crimes against Africans inside occupied territories. Now, this regime admitted that it gave thousands of Ethiopian women migrants shots of birth control contraceptives known as Depo-Provera without their consent. Now, this action may fit the legal definition of genocide. One of the women coerced to take the controversial contraceptive speaks here.
At the meeting, they said, you don't need to give birth so many times. If you give birth a lot, you will suffer in life. You need a job in Israel. So we said, if that's true, we will never be able to get out of here.
No doubt, the Israeli regime is inherently racist, and this has been confirmed by several political and religious figures of the regime. Now, last question to Matthew Parks. Are you surprised by these racist remarks by these Israeli rabbi?
Sadly, it doesn't. The nature of the Israeli government is based upon race. You know, they don't give full equal rights to the Israeli Arabs who have citizenship of Israel, who are about 20% of Israel. And of course, the Palestinian people who live in the occupied territories in the West Bank, East Jerusalem, Gaza, don't have the rights that normal citizens would have. And of course, Israel's right-wing governments have often used race, religion, and so forth as a political ideology. You'll find many times extreme right-wing politicians within the Israeli governments also, you know, espouse really offensive statements. There was reports about a deputy mayor of Jerusalem also making horrendous statements. And of course, the conflict makes it worse. I think part of the difficulty of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is that religion has become involved, land has become involved. So then it's often you find politicians resort to racism. So it really is a tragedy. And I think part of the reason why the majority of the world is condemning the governments of Israel's actions is because it's based upon race and religion. And that's really not, it's making matters so much more difficult and more difficult to resolve.
Following the Israeli regime's genocidal war on Gaza, there have been many anti-Israeli protests in Africa, like this one here.
Mine is the message to the aggressors. They've subjected our brothers to war crimes against humanity. What they're doing today is an extermination. Genocide. Is an extermination of our brothers in Palestine. And we say to them, no, no, no injustice, not in our era. We tell them, down, down, Israel.
Down, down, Israel.
Now, Mr. Hundein will have the last word in our program today. Do you think the Gaza conflict has laid bare the true racist and criminal nature of the Israeli regime?
Yes and no. Yes, in the sense that there were probably a number of people over the years who have been conditioned by sort of mainstream media perspectives to think of Israel as something that it was not. So for many years, for example, we used to hear that Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East. Right, so all these narratives presented the idea that, you know, even though there is a long-standing occupation of Palestine, of Gaza, of West Bank, Ramallah, but, you know, there's probably some explanation for it, or it's not always so, or it's this extremely complicated issue that nobody can understand. But what the events of the last few weeks and months have showed is that it's really not that difficult to understand what has happened here, that this is the same, this is a reiteration of the same kind of conflict that we saw for decades in Africa, which is colonial versus anti-colonial.
Well, there you have it. The U.S.-Israeli genocide against Palestinians in Gaza has revealed the colonial and criminal nature of the racist Israeli regime to African people. I'd like to thank our guests today, Matthew Parks and David Hundein, for their insight. Welcome to our Africa Rising section that focuses on interesting events in Africa, from innovations, achievements in science and technology to art and culture. Today we have Professor Pitike Ntuli, the South African sculptor, poet, writer, and academic. Pitike Ntuli is a living legend. He was at the front line of the struggle against the apartheid regime in South Africa, and this led to his exile. He also continues using the language of art to fight oppression.
I am a soul that emerged from the stench and the gutter of oppression and breathed hope in the atmosphere of despair. Child of a priest and a Sangoma uncle, I traverse the world of spirits through my art.
Thanks for your time, Professor, today. Now, can you tell us more about your activities in art that led to your exile?
It's kind of a very long story. When I was at in high school, I recited an English poet that was very political. Then I was warned not to read any political poems. Then when I did it for the second time, then I was expelled. And then from then on, the security police got interested in me, you know, because we were painting slogans, down with the past laws, down with the white regime. So I drew that attention, and then I was detained a couple of times. And then after that, I realized that I won't live long. So I had to flee first into Swaziland.
Thank you, Professor, for that. Now let's go to the next question. Briefly elaborate to us on the anti-imperialism and anti-colonialism messages in your works, including poems.
I mean, obviously, because I was censored when I used words, then I decided that I'm going to use the sculpture, and my sculptures are full of signs and symbols. They carry a lot of hidden meanings in them. They can be read at multiple levels. That's what I to do. But for the major big works, the big monuments, like a 20-ton Mandela, those I use granite. And granite is part of the soil. Therefore, it also is organic, and therefore it links. Even the choice of material itself is, for me, not only aesthetic, it is political as well.
Quite interesting indeed, Professor Ntuli. Now, can you tell us briefly, what is the difference between African art and the Western art?
Whatever we do, how people make art traditionally in our culture is totally different from what you're going to get in Europe, because art originally is meant also as a spiritual exercise. They're also part of religion. They are part of exchange of goods, like any material thing. But ultimately, they are of spirit. So if spirituality is not in there, then it is just simply a commercial piece without any lasting value.
Well, art is indeed interesting. Now, Professor, you have composed a poem on Palestine. Now, can you recite parts of the poem to our viewers, particularly at this juncture when Palestinians are facing a U.S.-Israeli genocide in Gaza?
Sons and daughters of Palestine, you walk in the land that is your own, but not your own. They killed a child in Jenin. I went to plant a flower, but already a red flower was growing. I put my finger on the flower. It came back dripping with blood. And with my dripping finger, I drew a map of Palestine and wrote Free Palestine. Israeli generals bombed the cloud. I was there with you in your thoughts when per se so. When you sit deep your pen in the eye of your child and write what it sees, if you dip your pen onto a child in Gaza today, what will you see?
Very moving indeed. I would like to thank Professor P.T. Ntuli for his time today. And that brings us to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. Goodbye for now.
Tawakkul comes from the root word wakala. Wakala means to appoint.
Today, I'd like to read to you an excerpt from
Allah is the unique Arabic name.
Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has decreed. His decree, though.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Foresight, and I'm your host, Mehdi. Please stay with us. كل شيء ومليك يا رب كل شيء وسامع يا خالق كل شيء. Today's great tip are various actions that we do, their positive and negative aspects, and their relationship to ubudiyya, our worship, our servitude, and our obedience to Allah. So, dear listeners, we are here at your service humbly talking about our various actions and their positive and negative aspects, as well as their relationship to our ubudiyya. Now, let's kind of start off with the second aspect. All of our actions have a direct or indirect effect upon our ubudiyya, right? The actions that we do, if they are good actions, if they are permissible actions, if they are wajib actions, obligatory actions, if they are halal actions, they are permissible actions, lawful actions, then these actions will have a positive impact upon our ubudiyya, our worship, our servitude, and our obedience to Allah. But on the other hand, if our actions are negative actions, they are actions which are haram actions, they are prohibited actions, or so these kind of actions will have a negative impact upon our ubudiyya, our worship, our servitude, and our obedience to Allah. And so the good actions will help us, the bad actions will be harmful to us when it comes to ubudiyya. Now, we have different parts of our body which will perform different kind of actions. So our hands, either they will, you know, conduct in writing or perhaps defending ourselves or, you know, being aggressive and bullying somebody else. Our eyes can either look at good things or bad things. Our tongues can either say good things or say bad things, right? As well as our ears and our feet and so forth. So we kind of want to go and talk about the positive aspects and the negative aspects of each one of these. Of course, keeping in mind that every single one of these parts of our body or these actions that we do and we undertake, these actions have an impact on our ubudiyya, right? So if they are good actions, they will have a positive impact on our ubudiyya, and it will move our ubudiyya, our worship, our servitude, and our obedience to Allah forwards. And of course, if God forbid, they are negative actions, they are things which are considered to be the disobedience to the Almighty Allah, then of course it will be harmful and destroy and prevent our ubudiyya, our worship, our servitude, and our obedience to Allah, both of them, you know, respective of how good the action is or how bad the action is. Inshallah, we continue after the break.
IRIB English Radio.
Our website is parstoday.ir.
رجائي بالرضا والخير أنير طريقي مع صديقي باحترام الغير.
And now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Osama Abdul Ghani.
Brothers and sisters, ikhlas in our actions, in everything that we do, not only in our prayers, which we're doing qurbatan Allah, but even in our social interactions. If a little bit there's nafs in it, a little bit looking for name and fame. Let me give you an example. Sometimes this happens in Muslim organizations even. In work that we want to do for the name of, in the name of God, in the name of religion. Once Bahlul was watching some individual, he's making a masjid. So Bahlul came over to him. He said, "Who's this masjid for?" He said, "Of course, the masjid for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala." He says, "Is that the case? Let me put my name on the masjid, Bahlul's mosque." And the guy said, "No, why should, my name should be on it. I should be, I'm doing all of this effort." Lack of ikhlas. I want my name to be on it. I'm doing Islamic work, but I want there to be somewhere, some notification, some people know who's making all this effort. I want everybody to know, everybody to recognize. Outwardly, very much Allah, ikhlas, Islam. Inwardly, what is it? Is it really ikhlas? Does it matter when I'm doing Islamic work? Does it matter if somebody else takes credit? Somebody else's name is on it. Does it matter to me? Will I still do the work? Somebody else is going to get credit. They're going to benefit. People will know them. They're the mu'mineen who did such and such. Do I still participate with the same amount of ikhlas and with Bahlul and this other guy? If you're doing it for God, God knows. If it's done for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, whoever's name is there, does it matter? God knows. If it's for him, it shouldn't matter. The guy, when he heard Bahlul say that, he said, look, whatever name you want to put on it, Bahlul's maaz, somebody else's maaz, he realizes there's no ikhlas there. They said that eventually Bahlul ended up putting an ayat of Quran on it. Right? But the idea of, from a practical point of view, is sometimes the reason that I won't cooperate with others, can't work with others, can't do projects with others. Part of it is sometimes that we have a difference of opinion. Part of it sometimes maybe I want credit. I want my name to be there. Let me give you an example from some of the shuhada, the ikhlas that they had. There was a shaheed and his name was Ismail Daqaiqi. Ismail. So what happened is that the brothers noticed, they said that when we would come into our bunkers at night, we would see that our boots had been waxed. Ismail Daqaiqi is the commander of the entire base. We would come into our bunkers at night and we see that somebody has come in the night and is waxing the boots of the other mu'mineen. And nobody knows who this is. Ikhlas. Middle of the... Let no one know. The more I can do work for Islam and nobody know that I've done anything. I'm an unknown soldier of the Imam of my time. I'm not on the front. I'm not in the... Right? But God knows. That's what's important. They said later we checked. We find out after checking, it's our commander.
IRIB English Radio.
Our website is parstoday.ir.
Welcome back to your listeners. This is Foresight on IRIB English Radio. So we were talking about in the previous segment how our actions, if they are positive, will have a positive impact on our ubudiyya. And if our actions are, God forbid, negative actions, then they will have a negative impact on our ubudiyya, our worship, our servitude, and our obedience to Allah. Now, actions, of course, are pretty much broken into our body parts, the main sensory aspects of the human body. So let's talk about, for example, with our feet. Now, we can use our feet in negative aspects, which will have a negative effect on our ubudiyya. And that is what? Well, that is, for example, going to a club or going to a casino or, God forbid, going to places which are even worse than these two. Going to these places, of course, not only do they have a lot of various branches of bad things, which we are also doing apart from that, but if we just limit ourselves to where we are going and where our feet are taking us, even though we are taking our feet, it is not our feet that are taking us, but still, these are the negative aspects and they have a negative impact on our ubudiyya. Now, on the other hand, so one, we need to prevent ourselves from the negative aspect. The other one is to encourage ourselves towards the positive aspect. So what's the positive aspect here? Well, of course, go to the masjid, go to the community center. If you are going for the sake of the nearness of Allah, then going to school, going to work, going back to your houses at the end of the work day or the school day. Going to the Kaaba, going to ziyarat of the imams, alayhim as-salam, going to Masjid al-Nabawi, going to the Kaaba, as we said, on Hajj or Umrah. These are all things that we can do with our feet, which are positive aspects, and they will have a positive impact on our ubudiyya. Our ears is the same thing. We can either listen to haram music, or we can listen to backbiting and gossiping, and we can listen to lies, or we can listen to swear words. Or these are the negative aspects, and they have, surely, definitely have negative impacts upon our ubudiyya. Or, you know, we can listen to nature. We can listen to the recitation of the Quran. We can listen to our families, our friends, you know, provided that the things that are being said is halal and permissible, and they're not haram and prohibited. Or listening to recitation of du'as. All of these are positive aspects that we can use our ears, and they'll have a positive impact upon our ubudiyya. Our tongue is the same thing. We can say good things, we can read the Holy Quran, we can read du'as, we can make a person happy, we can stand up to an oppressor, we can protect the rights of the oppressed. All of this with our tongue. And on the other hand, we can lie, or we can backbite, or we can cheat, or we can remain silent in front of the crimes and that the oppressor commits, or stays silent in front of the blatant oppression that is being done to the oppressed and the downtrodden, and vice versa. Our eyes is the same thing, and our hands is the same thing, right? We can write verses of the Holy Quran, we can write articles, we can write in support of the oppressed, we can write in standing up to the oppressor, we can write good things, or we can, you know, do bad things with our hands. So all of these parts of our body and our actions have positive and negative impacts. Negative impact will have a negative impact upon our ubudiyya, and the positive aspects will have a positive impact on ubudiyya. And this, dear friends, are the various actions, positive and negative aspects of each, and their relationship to our ubudiyya, our worship, our servitude, and our obedience to Allah. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Foresight. Don't forget to visit our website at farstoday.ir. Until another episode and another great tip, fi amanillah, and God bless you all. أحتمي بحما حسبنا الله ونعم الوكيل نعم المولى ونعم النصير حسبنا الله ونعم الوكيل نعم المولى ونعم النصير حسبنا الله.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
This is
for a better life.
For a better life. فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. IRIB English Radio again at your service. Welcome back, dear listeners, to the program for a better life. I am Beta, and once again, I have the honor and opportunity to be next to you in this road and long path of having a nice life. As you know, in the last episodes, we were talking about the approaches towards spirituality, and we talked about two important approaches which was discussed both in philosophy and the social studies, and also in our religion, the complete religion of Islam. The first one was the spirituality as combat with the self, or jihad al-nafs, and the second one was spirituality as a medicine. So in this episode specifically, we're going to talk about another method, way, and approach toward spirituality, which is a spirituality as a journey. In Islamic literature, spirituality is also described as a journey. We should think of ourselves as travelers, that we are here traveling, experiencing, and enjoying a beautiful journey. And as you know, we have all this mission towards this journey away from God, and then we're going back to Him. And as you are all aware of this beautiful verse from the Holy Quran, that you are from me and you are going to come and you are going to come back to me. And you can see the beauty of creation of human beings here, that we are all from the God Himself, and the destination of every human being is God. And in this journey, in this little and short journey, there are so many obstacles, there are so many challenges, there are so many times that you forget your destination, which is Allah Almighty. And this is the beauty of it. Let's keep it in the optimistic point of view. Here, this is so beautiful to have this mindset about the journey that we are going through. And, you know, we have all been created by God, and this creation is a sort of separation from our origin. Before we were created, we were not separate from God, but now we are. So, however, God has given us the chance to return to Him. Let's have this beautiful verse from the Holy Quran that I actually gave a gist of it to you. Truly we belong to God, and to Him we will return. It has a bit of a sad concept, because we recite this beautiful verse whenever one person dies. But it is, you know, deeper than that. It is something like we are facing in every day of our life. And I think this is not a verse of death. This is a verse of life. And when we depart, our destination is clear. But in order to reach our destination, we must be very careful about our direction. If we are on the right path, we will certainly reach our destination. As I told you, it's a little and short journey, but you know, it takes a lot of time, it takes a lot of energy. It takes you to be a real human being and use your whole potential in order to get to your destination. However, if we are on the wrong path, we will not reach our destination and may even go farther and farther away from it. Which is really sad, because you feel like lost, you know. When you talk to some atheist people, they are like, we are enjoying life. Oh, this tree is really beautiful. I'm enjoying its beauty. But when you ask them, so what? So what is the meaning of all this? They have nothing to tell you, you know. And you feel the depth of being lost in these people. I don't know why some people want to insist on whatever they are doing. Actually, this monologue reminded me of a verse in Holy Quran, which says that all of the people on the earth are aware of the truth of reality. The only reason why they want to oppose this reality and truth is that they want to be free to do whatever they want to do. And maybe this is a part of our nature, to be rebel, to be someone who wants to disobey Allah Almighty. But at the same time, the beauty of the story is that you have the will and you have the power to control yourself and to choose the right path. And as we have in the Holy Quran, Allah Almighty reminds us that I showed you the right path and the wrong path, and the choice is yours to choose whether you want to go through the right path or the wrong one. And let's keep it here. We're going to go for a short break, and then we're going to come back again, dear listeners. Stay tuned.
Your mercy, your love is all I need. It's all I need. All I need. It's all I need. It's all I need. All I need. All I need. All I need. All I need.
This is For a Better Life, and we are talking about the third approach towards spirituality, which is taking spirituality as a journey. Let's have another beautiful verse from Holy Quran. O man, you are trying hard to reach your Lord, and you will finally meet Him. Having read this verse, some may think that there is nothing to worry about because we have all come from a good place and there is a good destination ahead. But, you know, our status when we meet God is of utmost importance. There are two states of reaching God: to reach Him while He's happy with us, or to reach Him while He's angry with us. Human beings are among the very few creatures whose levels of perfection are not fixed. That is, they have been given the capacity to upgrade or degrade themselves, which is at the same time a huge responsibility on our shoulder and a blessing. Thus, the spiritual journey consists of trying to increase our closeness and proximity to God. It should be noted that God is always close to us, but we are not necessarily close to Him. And, you know, we can reach a position in which we can get closer and closer to God through self-purification, and as suggested by the glorious Quran, meet Him. There is the possibility of losing our own selfhood, limits and boundaries, and then becoming identified with God. That we have this actually beautiful concept in philosophy, in literature, in culture, everywhere. And this is a really vast, actually, topic that I don't have the knowledge to go through. But if you're interested in these kind of topics, I mean, the stage after you lose your selfhood and you go beyond your limitations, you go beyond your humanity, and you return to the Allah Almighty. This life is a journey, and we cannot say that we do not want to go on this journey. We are all on this journey, and it is up to us to gather enough provisions for ourselves. One of the main goals of self-building is to try to reduce this distance by wayfaring towards Allah. It means that the path towards Him is infinite and full of challenges. However, for the people who embark on this journey, all the support and guidance are provided. In this regard, there is a beautiful narration from Imam Sajjad, peace be upon him, that may you be glorified. What a narrow path it is for whom you do not guide, and what a clear path it is for whom you have guided. In this part, and in these three episodes, we have discussed spirituality, or the process of self-building as a kind of battle, medicine, and as a journey. Allah is encouraging and guiding us by demonstrating many ways and approaches towards spirituality and towards the last destination of the creation of human being. And He's showing us that there is always hope of reaching Him, and appeals to us in many different ways to encourage us to come closer to Him. He is the most merciful. Thank you, dear listeners, for listening to me. It was all the time I had for today's episode, unfortunately. I wish you farewell. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every grain of sand in every desert land he knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand he knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash he knows. Every thought I have and every word I share he
Limelight. American news outlets have cited U.S. intel officials as saying that almost half the bombs used by the Zionist regime in its war on the besieged Gaza Strip have been unguided dumb bombs. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Press TV wrote, these bombs, such as the M117, first entered service in 1950s and are exactly the same unguided M117 bombs seen in photos published by the Israeli regime military that regime warplanes have extensively dropped on Gaza since the events of October 7th. It is, however, unclear how many tons of explosives the Israeli regime military is injecting into these bombs. What is particularly alarming is that the regime has made no secret of its use of the munitions. These unguided bombs have killed about 20,000 Palestinians and injured more than 50,000 others, the majority of them women and children, and the majority of them have been left without limbs. Many thousands more are missing and believed to be trapped under the rubble, possibly dead. One of the objectives experts believe of using unguided bombs is to turn the civilian population of Gaza against the Hamas resistance movement by indiscriminately reducing their bombs to rubble on a massive scale alongside its death and destruction campaign targeting densely populated residential areas. Many Western powers, in particular the United States, have used similar tactics such as imposing sanctions on a civilian population in a failed attempt to turn the people against their government. During the 2006 July war, the Zionist regime waged on Lebanon, it failed to destroy the Lebanese Hezbollah resistance movement as it stated mission, but rather destroyed Lebanon in another botched attempt to turn the Lebanese nation against Hezbollah. The occupying regime is trying to do the same in Gaza with unguided bombs that cause significant damage and result in a series of massacres. Pertinently, these dumb bombs were widely used during the Second World War and have now largely been substituted by precision-guided munitions. In one of its latest statements, the Palestinian Health Ministry said one Israeli strike on the Jabalia refugee camp in northern Gaza killed at least 90 people. But this mission has also failed, as proven in a recent poll by the Palestinian Center for Policy and Survey Research, which is funded by the European Union, and found that support for Hamas has risen during the Israeli regime war on Gaza. The weapons lack any internal guidance systems or kits to improve their aim and generally follow the trajectory at which they are dropped. What they are doing on the ground in Gaza is causing significant death and destruction in the territory. CNN was the first broadcaster to break the story, citing three sources with knowledge of the latest U.S. intelligence assessment as saying that up to 45% of the 29,000 air-to-ground weapons used during the ongoing Zionist aggression on Gaza have been unguided. It means that the Israeli regime military has used upwards of more than 13,000 so-called DOM bombs in its devastating airstrikes on the coastal territory, turning it into a virtual graveyard. Reports say the rate at which the Zionist regime is using these bombs, which are nowhere close to being precise, is contributing heavily to the soaring civilian death toll in Gaza. Unguided bombs are more than likely to fall wide of their target and pose a significant threat to the civilian population, especially the vulnerable lot. Indiscriminate bombing is in violation of the Geneva Conventions and is widely regarded as a war crime. Experts have called it pure terrorism. Publicly, the U.S. National Security Council spokesman John Kirby said that the Israeli regime is doing everything they can to reduce civilian casualties. This is while the U.S. regime has itself been providing the regime with unguided munitions, including 5,000 MK-82 bombs. A source familiar with recent weapons transfers from the U.S. to the Israeli regime told CNN. The revelation has raised concern among humanitarian groups and others amid growing calls inside and outside the U.S. for the White House to impose conditions on any further military aid to the occupying regime. Despite the disturbing news, the administration of Joe Biden has rejected such calls, fearing a backlash from powerful and influential Zionist lobbying groups in Washington. Under international law, weapons are considered indiscriminate if they are not directed at military targets and instead target civilian sites. That's what has been happening in Gaza. With the Gaza Strip being a tiny territory that is home to 2.3 million people and just 360 square kilometers in size, the Israeli regime military has been found using large and sophisticated weapons. The news adds further weight that the Israeli regime's aim in this war on Gaza is to deliberately kill the civilian population of Gaza and starve the rest to death. If the Zionist regime was going after Hamas, why would half of the munitions it has dropped on Gaza be unguided, indiscriminate bombs that date back to wars waged in early 1950s. It is a well-known fact that the Zionist regime military has in its possession precision-guided missiles and smart bombs provided by the United States regime. Why has it not at least used precision weapons to target the Palestinian resistance factions, as is its publicly stated mission? Even some of the precision weapons, due to the size of the bomb, some of which are nearly 1,000 tons, can cause serious damage beyond the intended target. This is while the Zionist regime boasts of having the best intelligence on Hamas targets in the Gaza Strip. The Zionist regime's war cabinet has vowed to keep attacking Gaza until it crushes Hamas after one of the deadliest ground offensives of the war for its troops, even as it faces mounting international condemnation and calls for a ceasefire. Experts believe the reality is that the Israeli regime military has no chance of crushing Hamas and that its war on the Gaza Strip has already failed. The longer it pounds Gaza and operates in the territory, the higher the Palestinian civilian death toll will be, and more Israeli troops will perish. Calls are also mounting for the Israeli regime Premier Benjamin Netanyahu and his cabinet to be held accountable before an international tribunal for war crimes the regime is committing in the blockaded Gaza Strip.